Welcome to All Things Marine, Hawaii's thought-provoking show dedicated to marine science and ocean conservation. All Things Marine, brought to you by Kosi Island Earth and the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And now, here's your host, the marine science gal, Carly Weiner.
Aloha, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal on this Tuesday, September 19th, and today we are going to be learning about my favorite topic, marine mammals. Specifically, we are going to be exploring the recently completed, or still ongoing, 2017 Hawaiian Island Cetacean and Ecosystem Assessment Survey, otherwise known as High Seas. This was an incredible and still ongoing 187-day survey for cetaceans, which is whales and dolphins, as well as seabirds within U.S. waters of the Hawaiian Islands. Today we are going to get to talk to chief scientists working on the project and hear what they found, including Aaron Olson, Amanda Bradford from the Pacific Islands Fisheries Science Center and NOAA Fisheries, and Jeff Moore. We'll start with Jeff, calling in from San Diego. Jeff Moore is part of NOAA's Southwestern Fisheries Science Center, who has participated on the first leg of the expedition on the research vessel Reuben Lasker. Jeff, we're so happy you could call in. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you for making some time. So first, let's start with what is High Seas and what makes this kind of survey or expedition unique?
Right. So High Seas, you actually defined it a moment ago. It's the Hawaiian Islands Cetacean and Ecosystem Assessment Survey. It's a large-scale research cruise conducted by two large research vessels, NOAA research vessels, about 200-foot-long vessels that are patrolling about 2 million square kilometers of ocean, give or take, trying to document and quantify how many animals there are of all the different cetacean species in the U.S. waters surrounding Hawaiian Island.
Now, I'm very familiar with the guys here in Hawaii, but you're based in San Diego at a different NOAA lab. Is this the first time the Southwest Center has collaborated with the Pacific Islands Center before on a survey like this?
No. The Southwest Center in California and the Pacific Islands Center do a lot of collaborative work on marine mammals and sea turtles, among other things. And we've conducted at least two cruises quite similar to this one, two prior cruises quite similar to this one in 2002 and 2010.
Excellent. And so what makes this cruise different from those 2002 and 2010 cruises?
They're largely similar. They have the same objectives and are being conducted using most of the same methods. I'd say there are some important technological updates to this cruise compared to some past ones, including more sophisticated acoustic methods that we're using to detect dolphins and some other novel components such as drone survey methods, if you will. We call them UASs, unmanned aerial system surveys. People would know these as drones. Those are being used, and we also have kind of a couple novel sort of side objectives to this work. One of which, in particular, is trying to get a positive identification on a mysterious beaked whale species that we know is out there, that we hear around the tropics, but we don't know what species it is, and we're putting a little bit of effort into trying to untangle that mystery on this cruise.
Ooh, let's stop there for a second. We like mysteries. So, I mean, beaked whales are famously known for being elusive. Is this, a particular animal you're looking for, or a new species of beaked whale, or elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, we're not sure. Beaked whales are actually a really diverse group of cetaceans. There's about 21 or 24 or so known species. So they're actually a more diverse group than most marine mammals, but most people have never even heard of them because you never see them because they tend to live in deep open ocean habitats. And a lot of the species have been seen but never heard, or heard but never seen, or only seen from dead specimens that have washed up on the beach a few times. This particular species is one that's been heard a number of times with underwater acoustic listening devices, It's been heard throughout a range of the tropics, and we think it may be maybe a species that we call the ginkgo tooth whale, which is a species that's been seen, but we don't know what it sounds like. But we're not sure. It could be something new. We don't know.
So I'm sure our listeners are very familiar with what humpback whales sound like, and if they've never heard it themselves in person from movies Finding Nemo or Finding Dory, I'm sure they have some idea of what a humpback whale sounds like. But how would a beaked whale call sound in comparison? I mean, is it very different?
Well, this is maybe going to disappoint you, but to know what it would really sound like, you'd have to have really different ears. These animals call at higher frequencies than are audible to us. So, we'd have to slow that down and play it at a slow speed, like are sometimes done with bat calls, to get sort of a flavor for that. So, certainly quite different from whales like humpback.
I guess that means I'm not going to get you to do an impression on the show for us today.
I'm doing it right now. You just can't hear it.
Good answer. Very good answer. So, tell us a little more about your role on this expedition, Jeff. Were you out at sea, or were you manning things from back on shore, and how long were you out there?
A little of both. So you noted that there are two vessels conducting this work, one of which is the Reuben Laster, which is based in San Diego, and I'm the chief scientist on this cruise for that vessel. Aaron, who's on there with you, is the overarching scientist for this project and of the Oscar SETI, but I'm playing a semi-important support role for the Lasker, and I was on the first leg of the Lasker, which just got back into port in Honolulu about a week ago and is back out again now with a different cruise leader on its second leg.
Excellent. And is this the first time the Lasker has been in Hawaiian waters?
It is, yes.
Excellent.
The Lasker is actually a fairly new vessel. Its first cruise was in 2014, so just a few years ago. And I believe it has worked exclusively along the U.S. West Coast and in up toward Arctic waters so far. I don't think it's made a tropical trip yet.
Wow. Well, that's very exciting. So tell us a little bit more about this effort. I know we kind of touched on that there was one done in 2002 and 2010 and one now, and it's a little more technology focused, but why such a long and significant effort now? I mean, what's the purpose of it? Why is that so important?
Right, so this follows from our statutory legal mandate that we have been at the National Marine Fisheries Service have under acts such as the Marine Mammal Protection Act, Endangered Species Act. We're required to do certain science on the species in our U.S. waters, and we're required to specifically conduct regular what we call stock assessments. These are basically reports on the status of the different populations in the U.S. So, knowing how many of them there are, whether their populations are increasing or decreasing, knowing how many might be getting killed accidentally by ship strikes and in fishing nets and things like that. So we have these requirements to collect this kind of information, and that requires collecting data. So we do these cruises as often as we're able. In the case of the Hawaiian Islands area, they've been done in 2002, 2010, and now 2017. The effort is as large and expensive and time-consuming as it is, simply because we're trying to survey a really massive study area, and it just takes that long to cover that much ground to get decent estimates of how many animals are out there and where they are.
Absolutely, and aside from government mandate and assessment, what will this information help with? So once you collect the data, having these population assessments or updated stock numbers, will that translate to different policies or management, or what is that information used for?
Yeah, so great question, and absolutely. This is really the most fundamental set of information that we science centers collect in terms of forming the basis of decisions that the regulatory side, policymakers make concerning things like where to set aside protected areas, whether or not certain fisheries need to be regulated because they're interacting too much with certain populations. We collect biopsy samples from these animals as we're able to, and that provides genetic information for us to distinguish different populations of the same species. It really forms the basis of a lot of decisions that the agency has to make.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense to me. And so absolutely obvious that NOAA, you know, our federal management agency, is heavily involved in leading these efforts. But who else is involved in this plan? Are there academics and university partners as well?
Yeah, so the from a funding support side of things, this cruise is supported, in addition by NOAA, also by the U.S. Navy and by the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, both of whom conduct a variety of activities in U.S. waters that require them to fulfill certain permitting requirements concerning their potential interactions with marine mammals. So we've been working closely with them to compile the support necessary to conduct this survey, but also to identify the types of analyses and data products that are going to be produced to help fulfill all of the agency's needs in terms of meeting stock assessment requirements, but also meeting various permitting requirements for these different stakeholder partners. Yes, we do involve academicians in the work as well. Some of the hunt for the cross seamount whale that I talked about has some university partners involved. A lot of our contracted scientists on these cruises are often from universities.
So it's definitely not a one-man show. There's a lot of people involved and a lot of collaboration happening.
Indeed.
Excellent. Well, I have to say, you know, for those that have listened to the show for a long time, we know marine scientists love their acronyms, and you guys have done such a great job with acronyms for this, for the name of this project, the High Seas, and then also the PAC maps. What is the difference between High Seas and PAC maps, and how are they related?
Okay, so PAC map, which is a Pacific Marine Assessment Program for Protected Species, is a multi-agency partnership involving NOAA, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, BOEM, and the Navy, and as well as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It's a partnership that consists of a multi-year schedule, a five-year rotational schedule, as well as an implementation plan. And mainly I'm talking there about being able to pool funding resources to conduct these assessments in different areas of the ocean that are under U.S. jurisdiction. So this current survey, High Seas, is being done in U.S. waters off Hawaii, but there are other areas of the Pacific that we do these surveys, such as such as in the California Current, off the U.S. West Coast, and we're also looking forward to doing one of these up in the Gulf of Alaska. So basically, we have a rotational schedule of surveys. High Seas is one of those that fall under this PAC maps umbrella for helping us ensure that we're able to do these surveys in a regular way.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. So under PAC maps, what comes next after High Seas? Is there already another expedition or effort planned for, I guess, later in 2017 or early 2018?
So the next one in queue is our California Current cruise. Next year, starting in July of 2018, and that'll run for about 4 or 5 months, about 5 months as well, and we'll go up to the U.S.-Canada border and down into the northern Mexican waters At least that's what we're planning to do at this time.
Excellent. Are there any particular areas where you find the seas and whales are a little more cooperative? Like, is it easier to work here in the Hawaiian waters or versus California coast? Or
yeah, right. Definitely. Definitely areas, calmer areas, areas easier to work. Hawaii does not fall into that category. You have a little climatological phenomenon in that area called the trade winds, and it makes for pretty rough conditions in most of the time.
Yes, spotting dorsals and spouts in high wind environments does not make life easy, does it?
Right, it's a little tricky.
Excellent. So now, you were on the Reuben Lasker, is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, good. So there was the Reuben Lasker and the SETI, and having these two different vessels working together. How did that effort work in terms of allocation of tasks and talking to each other? How did that go? Is that the first time that that's been done?
Right. So the cruises in the Hawaiian waters typically use two vessels because it's a massive study area, and it just takes two vessels to get the job done. Aaron is really the overall architect of this whole thing. So she had the job of chunking up the study area into different parts and delegating those to different legs and different vessels. So she pretty much told me where to go. yeah.
Excellent. Well, that was one of my other questions, is how the different offices, how do their roles differ? You know, are you just going dividing up by area or by species, or and you know, are you checking in at the end of the day? Like, how does that whole system work?
Sure. So dividing up mostly by area. Yep. Different vessels working different parts of the study area at the same time. Regular check-ins for sure. You know, the vessels have Wi-Fi, internet. Not always that work as well as you'd like them to, but they work well enough for us to stay in touch. And we're able to coordinate pretty well on what's been getting done daily and what's needing to get done and who's going to go where to make sure that in the end we've covered the study area pretty comprehensively. The Lasker is, as we noted, a California-based vessel and is mostly being crewed by scientists that are from my center, and whereas the SETI is being crewed mostly by scientists from the Pacific Island Center. And yeah, we just have a good history of working together and accomplishing this stuff.
Now, rumor has it you're the seabird guy. So what's a seabird guy doing on marine mammal cruise?
Okay, well, I think the operative word there is rumor. Certainly, I'm keen on birds, but no, I'm a cetacean ecologist first and foremost. There is a strong seabird component to this cruise. The vessels have highly qualified marine mammal observers and seabird observers, so they're up on the flying bridge of the vessels at the same time, looking for different things. Really good opportunity I would say it would be a real missed opportunity to not get information about seabirds while we're out there, because these cruises are do take a lot of resources, and so we try to collect as much information about as many things as we can while we're out there.
Excellent. And I imagine the process of looking and observing for marine mammals and seabirds is different. So how do you study them simultaneously, and what are some of these things you're looking for?
Uh-huh. So the marine mammal observers are standing up on top of the ship, we call it the flying bridge of the ship. It's about 15 meters above the surface. I think that's right. And they're standing, looking through these really huge binoculars that are mounted on stands, on pier mounts. These are 25 power by 100 millimeter aperture binoculars, and they give you the vision to see dolphins jumping out of the water 5, 6, 7 miles away. So we're scanning at quite a distance, looking for whales and dolphins. The seabird observers, also highly trained, highly skilled, are sitting up there next to the mammal observers. They're using just naked eye, and they're counting the birds that are in pretty close range to the vessel, out to about 300 meters or so in front and to the side of the vessel, and counting just about everything that flies through that strip.
So what kind of seabirds did you guys see so far?
We have seen, I know I'm just going to speak for the leg one of the Lasker, because that's what I know about right now. And we had 42 species sighted during that 3-week long period, from a real diverse set of bird groups: albatrosses, petrels, shearwaters, tropic birds, frig birds, boobies, terns, skuas, jaegers, all kinds of stuff. The most common were wedge-tailed shearwaters and sooty terns, which breed there in the Hawaiian Islands. But we also saw, and a lot of things that we saw were year-round residents in the area or things that are seasonal breeders there in Hawaii. But there were also some little gems from visitors from elsewhere that were just passing through that maybe we saw only a couple examples of, things like sooty shearwaters and some petrels that really don't use the tropical waters very much, but come through on occasion or just migrate through. And so those are pretty exciting to see.
Excellent. Well, it sounds like it's been a really productive leg one, and I really appreciate you taking some time to talk to us today, Jeff. We're going to take a quick break, but when we return, we'll learn more about marine mammals in the high seas.
Quarterback looking, firing across the middle. Wow, what a grab in traffic. Larson really had defenders hanging all over, but somehow he comes up with the football.
On the football field, you've got to stay focused and not get distracted.
NFL Hall of Famer and President and CEO of CTIA, the Wireless Association, Steve Largent.
The same is true on the road. So before your wireless phone becomes a distraction, take a time out for safety. Place your phone in easy reach before you leave. Never take notes or look up a phone number while you're driving. In bad weather or traffic, call later. Dial sensibly and use a hands-free device. You know, your wireless phone can be your best safety tool to call for help, stop a crime, or help someone in need. However you use it, remember, with wireless, safety is your call.
The wireless industry reminds you to drive safely. For more information, visit www.wirelesssafety.org.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal, and today we're talking about the amazing research effort that just took place and is still taking place here in the northwestern and main Hawaiian Islands, focusing on marine mammals. With us now is Aaron Olson, co-chief scientist of the project and leader of the cetacean research program, as well as Amanda Bradford, PhD research ecologist, who both work for NOAA's Pacific Island Fisheries Science Center. Welcome to the show, ladies.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So we just had a great time talking with Jeff, who not just does seabirds, but marine mammals as well. Let's go back to some of the basics for those people that are just joining us. Aaron, what are the high seas and what really is the goal of the expedition?
Yeah, so high seas, as you said in the intro, is the Hawaiian Islands Cetacean and Ecosystem Assessment Survey. And as Jeff really nicely explained, it's part of a broader effort, partnership really, between NOAA Fisheries, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, Navy, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and a bunch of other partners to collect the data that we need in order to estimate how many of each species of whales and dolphins we find out here in Hawaii. And alongside that, we're doing seabird surveys at the same time, with the goal of understanding basic at-sea distribution of seabirds and the role that they play in the ecosystem, because they are really great indicators of ecosystem change and local oceanographic conditions. So we do all of that by collecting visual survey, looking for the animals using large binoculars, as Jeff explained. And we also have an acoustic component where a group of acousticians has an array that they're towing behind the ship, listening for animals, because a lot of species are a lot easier to detect acoustically than they are to see while they're underwater making noise and communicating with each other. And then we collect some other oceanographic data as well. And the package of all of this together really goes into generating the abundance, but also abundance estimates for all the species, but also understanding their range and structure and the role of the ecosystem in their distribution.
And I just want to diverge for a minute, too, because for those people that have never been out on one of these expeditions or can't really imagine, you know, what that's like, you know, paint a picture for us, because there are certain species that you see pretty commonly. I think everyone here in Hawaii has at least probably once seen a Hawaiian spinner dolphin, you know, shoreside, and some of the smaller dolphin species are pretty common or easy to recognize. But what happens when you see something that is unexpected or that is rare? Like, and how did that happen on the legs that you've been on yet?
Sure. So unlike around shore, where it's fairly common to see spinner dolphins, we actually very rarely see spinner dolphins out at sea, because they are very island associated. They're really tightly affiliated with the bay, resting bays around the islands. And so we aren't really able to survey that area. But so we're really a lot more capable of finding a lot of the pelagic species. So all the other dolphinids and the large whales that are found around Hawaii, there are 25 species that we know are occurring here. And so trying to find those along the way. As far as surprises go, I guess it's not really a surprise. We've been out there specifically hoping to find false killer whales because they are a real focus species for us. But I think it was surprising. We actually had several really nice encounters with false killer whales during the first leg of the survey, where we were able to collect a lot of photos and a couple of biopsy samples and other information that's really going to be important for understanding sort of who those false killer whales are and what part of the larger false killer whale population they are. There are three populations of false killer whales around Hawaii, and just because you see them in one place or time doesn't mean you know which population they're from, and dissecting that is really important in order to get the right answer out of the data. As the cruise leader and the chief scientist, I get really excited when we see false killer whales, because I know it's one of our main focuses of the study, and it just to me it's fun. I think the observers and the acousticians might disagree. I don't think they particularly love it when we see false killer whales. In fact, I think false killer whale, or Pseudorca, which is the genus name, are almost like swear words on the flying bridge. That they're not particularly excited, because it means we have very strict data collection protocols to make sure that we collect all the data that we need. And it just becomes a pretty long process that doesn't have a lot of room for deviation. And so that just means that they might have lunch a bit late, or we all might be up there sweating away in the sun for quite a while. But in the end, it's a big reward. So I think we all appreciate it.
Bet a lot of excitement and tension all at the same time. And false killer whales, just for clarification, for those that don't know, they're not orcas or the traditional killer whales that you see that are just pretending to be something else, right?
That's right. They're not a killer whale in someone else's clothing. They're called false killer whales because the shape of their head is similar to a killer whale, just smaller. But in fact, they're quite different in terms of their ecology and just the look of them. They're almost entirely all black. They're very sleek, dolphin looking, but still quite large. That's not as big as a killer whale itself. But they're highly social, which is actually fairly similar to killer whales, where they form these sort of not quite family, but tight social groups that they tend to affiliate with and stay with over time. And that makes them really interesting from a biology and to an ecologist. It also makes them hard to study sometimes, because you can't just treat any false killer whale like any other. You have to really know that animal's history and what population they belong to really know that you're really understanding what role they're playing.
Sure. And in terms of those 25 species, how many have you guys knocked off the list so far on this expedition?
Let's see.
I think we're up to 17.
That's pretty good.
And there are a couple, like we count North Pacific right whales, because they've been seen here, you know, a handful of times over the last several decades.
But wow,
that would be extremely rare and amazing should we see a North Pacific right whale. And there's a couple others like that we see, the migrating baleen whales, like blue whales and fin whales. we might have rare visitors in the winter, but we're not going to see them regularly. So we're actually doing really well. There's only one or two species that we would expect to see more commonly that we're still waiting on, and I'm pretty certain we'll see them.
So, Amanda, any new species for you on this cruise that you've seen?
I did have a new species, and the highlight of our last trip, we only had one false killer whale sighting, and we were more focused on the exciting beaked whale sightings that we had, including a really large group of Longman's beaked whales. Their genus name is Indopacetus, so we often call them Indopacetus. But back in 2010, when this survey occurred, there was a really large group of the beaked whale seen as well, and it was kind of exciting. It was almost 100 animals, the largest documented sighting of that species, and we thought that it was this really anomalous thing and that it was very exciting. Well, almost in relatively the same place, only about 150 nautical miles away on the leg I was just on, leg two of the study, we had another sighting of a very large group, maybe not quite 100, maybe 60 or 70 Longman's beaked whales. And my measure of how exciting a sighting is how many people from the bowels of the ship, like the engineers and the officers on watch, how many of those people come out to the bow or the bridge wings to look at the species that is being seen. And that the ship, I was like, is anybody left running the ship? Because everybody seems to be on deck watching. It was very exciting to see this huge group of this very rare, very funny looking beaked whale just right there. So that was exciting for me.
Wow, I think that would be exciting for anybody. Fantastic. So logistics wise, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of moving parts. How do you plan, Erin, for such an enormous undertaking?
Yeah, so it's been sort of a long road. Jeff was talking about pack maps, and we started the process of working with the Navy and BOEM back in March of 2016 to start securing the funding for this effort. And that was definitely a process and a lot of negotiation and discussion, but the real meat of the planning for high seas started in January of this year. Where we have myself and our cruise coordinator, Kim Yano, here in Hawaii, and then there's Jeff, and they have a cruise leader, Annette Henry, in San Diego, and the four of us basically had calls every other Tuesday from January until July, where we would lay out, figure out our staffing and figure out our budgets and the equipment needs and all of the protocols and the data collection and what needed to be updated and everything else. And then we would all go off and scatter and do our assigned tasks and come back 2 weeks later on Tuesday and talk about the roadblocks or what we finished. And so I have to say, it was really kind of all consuming for me. Amanda and I together, we've done a lot of survey work, but I've never felt like my entire life was dedicated to one survey. For such a long period. And in some ways, getting on the ship in July felt like the end. it was sort of the release from just thinking about it and planning it and actually doing it.
Well, and then getting off the ship afterwards, too.
Yeah, and I can actually say now it's not the end.
That's true. Now, I mean, going out there, are you just kind of driving the boat around, hoping to look for whales? Or Amanda, what type of survey design do you implement to find these species? I mean, they're moving around a lot. So how do you know where to go? And what do you do once you spot one?
Well, we use a survey design called line transect. And that's where we establish a grid of transects, or what we more commonly call track lines, that representatively sample or take us on the ship through our study area. So we're actually covering areas where animals are and where they aren't. And that allows us to get a density estimate or a estimate of animals per unit of area for that whole area. And people often ask us, why do you do that? Why don't you just go to the area where animals are? Well, we couldn't do that for all the places in our study area where there are animals. And if we just went to a few places where there are animals and then extrapolated that to the study area at large, we would overestimate density. And kind of the same thing. I mean, we would have no reason to go where animals aren't, but if we only went there and then extrapolated that, we would underestimate. So we run these track lines so that we representatively but comprehensively cover the study area. We get a density estimate that we can then multiply by the area of our study area, and that allows us to get an abundance or a population size for each of the species that we see.
Wow, so it's a lot more detailed than just driving the boat around looking for animals.
It's a lot more detailed. And then once we are running those track lines, you know, we don't expect that we're going to see everything within our visibility range, but we use math to help us estimate what we call detection functions, using what information from what we do see to get estimates of what we aren't seeing. So it's sort of simple in principle, a little bit more complicated once you start doing the math, but overall we're just trying to use the snippets of information that we get and the sightings that we can see to tell us, you know, as much as we possibly can about all of the animals and that we're not seeing and all of the places where we aren't able to go.
Excellent. Well, we're going to hold that thought, take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about some of these methods and tracking down marine mammals.
You mean I could have diabetes and not even know it?
Then why would I want to know?
Heart disease, amputations, stroke, blindness can all be caused by diabetes. So it's critical that you know. If you're over 45, you don't exercise, and you're overweight, you're at risk. But a simple blood test can detect the problem, and with early treatment, you can prevent the devastating effects of diabetes. Call the American Diabetes Association at 1-800-DIABETES. Don't be blind to diabetes.
Mom?
Dad?
How long should I wait for you?
Mom?
If I'm at soccer practice,
what if something happens? Will you come get me?
There's no reason not to have a plan in case of a terrorist attack.
Mom, if you're not home, should we go to the neighbor's house?
And some extremely good reasons why you should.
Can you tell me?
Everybody should have a plan. Take 5 minutes to talk about where you'll meet and how you'll get in touch with each other in an emergency. For other things you can do to be prepared, visit www.ready.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal, and we are talking about marine mammals and some amazing efforts that have been going on over the summer and continue to go on throughout the rest of this year. Here with Aaron and Amanda from NOAA's Pacific Island Fisheries Center, and we were just chatting in the break. I asked, had they actually seen any orcas? And it sounds like, yes, you had.
We did. During leg one, we had a really lovely encounter with some killer whales. The observers called down that the killer whales were approaching us, and they ended up passing, like, all surfaced about 50 meters off the stern of the ship and then dove under the hydrophone array and then came out the other side and kept on going. And it, like Amanda said, with the longman-beaked whales drawing everybody out onto the bow, it was sort of similar that anybody that could possibly get to the stern of the ship in the 30 seconds that they had to see these killer whales was there. And it was a really beautiful sight and a really amazing sighting. And we spent a while trying to keep up with them and collect some more data, but they are awfully sneaky, and they managed to get away. Killer whales in Hawaii are probably hunting mammals, and so as part of that, because mammals are keen listeners, they're very quiet, and so we couldn't use our acoustic tools to relocate them like we can with a lot of other species.
Wow, that's incredible. That's pretty rare. You know, I've heard people seeing them before, but haven't been fortunate enough myself. So you talk about acoustic arrays, and Jeff talked earlier about drones, and Amanda just talked about some of the line transects. So there's a lot of thought going into how you're observing these marine mammals and the data that you collect during these encounters. I know there are four different research components, Aaron, that are part of the study. Can you talk a little bit more about these?
Sure. Yeah. So the first component we've talked a little bit about is the visual survey, and so that's the really the heart of the effort, in that those are the basic data that we absolutely have to collect. And so this is the mammal observers and the seabird observers that are on the flying bridge keeping watch for their respective species, and then collecting all of the data that they can when each of those is sighted. And at the very minimum, that includes where the animals are with respect to the ship, what species they are, and then the size of the group that they're seeing. And when we can, we try to approach and get additional information, whether it's photographs or biopsy samples or deploy satellite tags. So that's one component, and that really drives the survey design that Amanda described. The other main component is this passive acoustic effort, where we have a hydrophone array that's being towed behind the ship. Hydrophones are essentially underwater microphones. And a lot of cetacean species are really vocal, in fact, more vocal than they are easy to see. So just by listening, much higher chance of hearing them and then tracking them down than you could based on looking alone. And so it's a really valuable part of our effort because it's really increases our encounter rate and lets us have access to animals that we might have completely missed otherwise. And for certain species, it's really the only way we would even know that they were there. Like Jeff talked about the cross-seamount beaked whale. The third component is the oceanographic sampling, and that's the ecosystem part of high seas. And so that includes actually not only the seabirds themselves, but also conducting conductivity temperature depths. We call it CTD casts down to 1,000 meters. We do those twice a day. And the idea is to really be capturing the oceanographic conditions throughout the study area while we're there. And that provides a lot of context for all the cetacean and bird data that we're collecting. And then the last piece is according to this amorphous other stuff. And it includes basically all the new technology and partner projects that we've invited to come along the effort. And so we have a lot of new acoustic technology that we're testing out or implementing as part of high seas. One of those is these drifting acoustic buoys that are listening while they drift around on the currents. And that's a really new component for us. It's been really exciting, mostly just watching where they go over very short periods of time, but are going to be really valuable data for beaked whale abundance. And then we've started to incorporate this drone work that Jeff mentioned at the beginning, and Amanda can talk more about that. She's our newly minted drone pilot. But the idea there is just to collect imagery that can help us learn a lot more about individual animals. And then and there's a bunch of side projects with the water collection for eDNA and servicing acoustic buoys for some of our partners. And so just trying to capture all of those other pieces that really we're trying to make high seas as much as it can be for as many partners as we can because it's a great opportunity.
So you guys weren't bored. You had lots to do.
No, we were not bored.
Yeah. Amanda, I wanted to talk to you more about the drones that Jeff mentioned and what does it entail to be a cetacean drone pilot?
Well, this is a new program for us, so we're still maximizing its full potential. The drone that we're using is a hexacopter. And there's a lot of information that you can get from flying drones, or in our case, a hexacopter, that it was either not possible to do in the past, or maybe it was possible, but it was really expensive because you had to use a plane. And you can take this in a number of directions. For example, there are researchers that are now using drones to collect blow, or you could just say snot, from whales to look at their health. We're not doing that exactly, but what we are doing is trying to use this hexacopter to collect information on population and individual health. And the population health aspect that we're monitoring is reproductive output. So specifically looking at the proportion of moms with calves that are in groups of whales and dolphins that we see. And that can give us some measure of how many new recruits to the population are occurring over time and gives us a way to look at how they're doing. And we're also using a tool called photogrammetry where we take images of individual whales and dolphins and measure their size and shape. And we can look at how thin or how fat animals are relative to their body length. And that gives us a way to look at their body condition so we can see how they're doing and kind of track that over time. So we're still getting this program up and running. We have been able to do a few several successful flights during high seas. But one minor issue for us, as Jeff referred to earlier, is that we have these lovely trade winds, which are great. You know, in some respects, it's harder for when we're trying to do some work, including flying a somewhat wind-sensitive instrument, as well as the images that we collect. If the animal itself is just obscured by big waves, and we're not going to get a lot of good information. So we're trying to take advantage of these rare but wonderful opportunities that we have to fly the drones, especially in the open ocean where we're not going to be able to get access very often. So it's been fun, and I think that it's something that we're going to be able to develop and kind of carry out in a number of ways in coming years.
Absolutely. Lots of respect to you. I mean, for those of you that have flown drones in the park for fun, recreationally, it's a very different thing when you're out at sea trying to do a targeted
flight. It's a little scary.
Yeah. Our team put our drone right into the A-frame on the first day. So if it makes you feel any better. It's not
okay,
easy
I feel better.
Thing.
We didn't do that.
So how big of an area did you guys cover, have you been able to cover so far on the expedition?
Let's see, I think we're up to about over 6,000 square nautical, or 6,000 nautical miles that we've covered in our almost 2 million square nautical mile study area. It's kind of hard to put in perspective, but I think we covered something like 13,000 nautical miles of daytime track line during the 2010 effort. So we're not quite halfway there, but we still have a ways to go. But we're covering some ground.
That's amazing. And so you guys continue to do this till December. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. And is it the same scientists, or you guys kind of swap out so you don't go completely stir crazy being at sea for 4 months? Or how does that work?
So the main core of the science staff do stay out for the whole time. So there's a group of observers and acousticians who are on the SETI, and then a separate group, obviously, on the Lasker. And actually, once the SETI is done with its mission later in October, some of those scientists will go to the Lasker. And the idea is that we really want – that helps us get consistency with all the data collection by using the same people for as long as we can. The one group that does get to swap out is the cruise leader. And in part, that's because being the cruise leader sometimes is a little bit slow, but sometimes means lots of late nights editing and checking and keeping up with all of the data that's being collected during the day. And, you know, sort of being the decision maker while you're at sea, and it you get tired. It's kind of exhausting by the end. And so we swap out cruise leaders every leg. Yep, as I said, the SETI will be finishing up in later in October. So that group of staff that will have been out at sea for almost 90 days by then can go off and enjoy the beach and take a vacation while the Lasker crew continues on until December.
Wow. And so we talked earlier, 17 species already found out of 25, which is just incredible. So how many actual animals or spottings? Do you have any totals for that? Because I'd be really curious.
So as of last week, when the two ships came in from Lasker's Leg 1 and SETI's Leg 2, we were up to 170 sightings of those 17 species. The ships have been back out now for most of this week, and so there's definitely a handful more to add to that. So we're doing quite well. Acoustics usually hears almost twice as much as we see, so they're probably up to 300 or so acoustic detections by now. Yeah, we've been seeing a lot, and in terms of how many animals those represent, so these population numbers that we're so interested in, that will take a long series of time and effort to crunch all of those numbers. But it's good. We're above our average. The sighting rates of these species are pretty low in the study area. We're kind of lucky sometimes if we see one sighting a day, but our averages have been quite a bit more than that so far. So we're lucky. It keeps us from going too crazy and just staring at windy water.
So you'll be able to take these numbers then and extrapolate to better understand population numbers?
Exactly.
Wow. And so is it too early to tell if, you know, you're seeing increases or decreases or, you know, stabilization in populations, or how long does it take for you to figure that out after the data is collected?
It will take us several months to maybe a year or two, depending on exactly how far we go into estimating these numbers and trying to account for various things. So it's really early to tell. And I think you have a somewhat skewed perspective. Like, for example, I was just out on Leg 2, and where we were in the study area, kind of the northwestern portion of it near a bunch of seamounts, we were seeing striped dolphins like several times a day, day after day. And we would get really excited. We would see some dolphins splashing in the distance, and we're like, okay, oh, striped dolphins, you know. And so we start to think, oh, striped dolphins are everywhere. They're doing fine. They're exploding. But you have to keep it all in perspective and kind of look at the data in whole and think about the conditions that you have at that time that allow you to see those things. And so all these things that we have to be factored in when we're doing the estimation work give us a better sense of what's going on. We can't necessarily relate it to what we're seeing at the time because we're influenced by so many other things.
Yeah, that makes sense. And what about the photo ID work? So for those people that don't know, you know, you guys are snapping away a lot of pictures of like the whale paparazzi when you're out there, when you see, and that's to look at dorsal fins and maybe fluke prints to identify individual species. Was there a lot of that on this expedition?
There was a lot of that. We've taken tens of thousands of photos already. And Yeah, so most individuals of most cetacean species, they can be individually identified in some way, whether pigmentation patterns on some part of their body, like their flukes, or nicks and notches on their dorsal fins. And we use it kind of like we use fingerprints for us, that these are the fingerprints of the animals. And if we take pictures of them, it allows us to, and they have to be of a certain quality, like really high quality images, and then we can track those animals through space and time. And it's a really powerful tool for looking at individual things on an individual level.
Excellent. And are there easier species to work with for photo ID or?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, those that come close to the ship are easier for sure. And if you ask some of our photo ID matchers, they would say that even some of those that come close are quite hard. There's this running joke of one fin per frame, because, you know, there's some species like melon-headed whales that tend to clump up really closely together, and you snap one picture and you just captured 6 or 8 or 10 individual animals, and that's even with a 400 millimeter zoom lens. But species like that actually are pretty easy to do photo ID with, because they tend to have a lot of these distinctive nicks and notches on their fins. And the other aspect of it is that when they're sort of reliably seen in certain areas, so you know you have access to them again. And so melon-headed whales in particular, we know that there's populations that come in close to the main Hawaiian Islands and that have been well photographed through time. And so collecting photos while we're out at sea on high seas, we have this really rich historical data set to compare that to understand where those animals have been seen before. And that also informs some of the abundance analyses.
Very cool. And Erin, you mentioned earlier biopsy work and sampling. For those of us that don't know what biopsy sampling is, what is that and what is that telling you about the animal?
Sure. So biopsy sampling is basically collecting a small piece of tissue from the animal. And the way that we do this is we have a little, we call it a bolt. I guess it kind of looks like an arrow, but it doesn't have a sharp tip on the end. It has just like a little round thing that when it hits the animal, it just collects a little bit of skin and blubber, and then it retains it inside the arrow. And then we pick up the arrow and we have our piece of tissue. So for a small dolphin, like a spinner dolphin, it's basically like as big around as your pinky. And, you know, a couple of millimeters deep. And for something like a large whale, it's maybe, you know, half the length of your pinky, but that same diameter. So it's not a large amount of tissue for an animal of this size, but it is really valuable. And so within each biopsy sample, we're getting both the skin, which holds the genetics, the DNA of the individual, which tells us about who their parents are, what population they belong to, how they relate to other animals in the area. And then also, the blubber or the next tissues down contain hormones and a lot of information about what the animals have been eating. And so we can really mine these individual biopsy samples for quite a few different types of analyses. The most important for us is the genetic analysis, understanding how the animals all relate to each other. But in some cases, where we've collected a biopsy sample from an individual or from a population in large numbers, we'll end up using those samples for other things like examining stable isotopes, which tells us what are these animals eating, or examining things like contaminants. So how are they exposed to contaminants in their environment that might impact their health? And so that's how we use most of the biopsy samples.
And you wouldn't typically, when you come across a pod of a species, you do every single one. You usually do kind of one biopsy per sighting type situation.
Yeah, we try to collect a handful. So on the order of, you know, ideally, it would be something like 5 to 8 samples from a group, say, of 30 or more animals. Mm-hmm. But that's actually pretty rare that we get that opportunity, unless we have animals that are bow riding, like right on the bow of the ship. And so then they're more accessible. But oftentimes, you're right, we end up with, you know, 1, 2, maybe 3 biopsy samples from a group. But nonetheless, it still gives us a really nice sort of snapshot capture of what that group is and who they are.
That's incredible. I find that, you know, just how you do it so interesting, and how you're collecting all this information. So real quickly, because we have to wrap up here, Amanda, where can people go to learn more and follow the expedition as it continues?
We have a website. It's at www.pifsc.noaa.gov/hicaes/. It's a website dedicated to this project. We have lots of components of it that are being updated. So we invite you, www.pifs.noaa.gov/highseas. Come check it out.
Excellent. And another exciting opportunity to learn more about our oceans, we will be doing free ship tours of the NOAA ship Okeanos Explorer and Schmidt Ocean Institute Falkor. And that's on Sunday, October 1st from 10 to 4 at Pier 35. I'd like to thank all my guests today, Aaron, Jeff, and Amanda, for coming here, and our sponsors, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.